From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, Adam McKay. He directed and co-wrote the hit comedy Anchorman with Will Ferrell. It's just out on DVD. It's a satire of local TV news in the 70s, when newsmen were newsmen and women covered cat shows. McKay also wrote the upcoming film version of Bewitched, which stars Ferrell as Darren. Also, an adaptation of Shakespeare's The Merchant of Venice is headed to the silver screen. Film critic David Edelstein will have a review, and we'll hear from Jeremy Irons. He plays the merchant Antonio. His other films include Dead Ringers, Stealing Beauty, and The French Lieutenant's Woman. He won an Oscar for his role in Reversal of Fortune. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davey, senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, filling in for Terry Gross. Anchorman, the film satirizing local TV news shows of the 70s, has just come out on DVD. It was directed and co-written by our guest Adam McKay, who Terry interviewed when the film was in theaters. The anchorman in the film, Ron Burgundy, the top-rated anchor in San Diego, is played by Will Ferrell, who also co-authored the screenplay with McKay. McKay and Ferrell first worked together on Saturday Night Live, where McKay was head writer. He's an alum of the Chicago-based comedy theater group Second City and was a founding member of the Upright Citizens Brigade. The news team in the movie Anchorman covers all kinds of fluff with an affected sense of gravity. Let's get in the mood by listening to the opening of Anchorman's Channel 4 news show.
For San Diego news you can count on, trust only the best. The Channel 4 news team. With seven-time Emmy Award-winning anchorman, Ron Burgundy.
I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
Champ Kind with the latest in sports.
Whammy!
Rick Tamland with up-to-the-minute weather.
38 degrees in the Middle East.
Brian Fantana, your man in the field.
Panda watch. The mood is tense.
And our newest reporter, Veronica Corningstone.
It was quite a show down here at the Pet Shack.
So when you're looking for serious news, look no further than the Channel 4 news team.
Adam McKay, welcome to Fresh Air. Now, Anchorman is set in the 70s at a time when local news had a lot less competition than it does today because it's the pre-cable era. how do you see like the importance of like, you know, the local news and the local news anchors in the period that your movie set?
Well, they were huge back then. That was three channels, so they really were like the voice of God in their community. And, you know, when they would do a promotional deal at a shopping mall or something, you would have like 30,000 people would show up for these things. I remember when I was a kid, you know, I lived in a little town outside Philadelphia. Don Tolleson, who was the local sports guy in Philadelphia, came to our town and literally 10,000 people showed up. And I got Don Tolleson's autograph, and it was like, you know, Elvis had whipped a sweaty towel at me or something. I was just as thrilled as can humanly be. And I'm not sure that would be the case anymore. I think Don Tolleson would be surrounded by about eight people in the park if that happened now.
Well, you know, it's such a really funny parody of the news. And you have your opening news collage in which, you know, all of the anchors and reporters walk onto the set. Would you describe how that looks?
Oh, yeah. Well, that, you know, a lot of that came directly from real tapes we saw of the 70s news openings, you know, from Jessica Savage and Mort Krim back in the mid-70s. And basically the whole sort of theme that I'm sure they were thinking was, you know, we command the city. So it's a lot of pushes and tight shots. And then our favorite element of it is in the end, they had the entire news team all look up in the camera with a, quote, serious journalist stare at the same time. And instantly Will and I were laughing and saying that is just directly going into the movie. So that actually is in the movie, and that's taken from Mort Krim and Jessica Savage circa, I think, 75 or 76.
What are some of the favorite headlines that you wrote for Anchorman?
You mean the fake news stories?
The fake news stories, yeah.
Well, some of the best fake news stories were the ones Will just suddenly became a master at improvising these fake news stories, and he would always give you little tastes of them as you came out of other stories. And we would just marvel at the fact that he probably came up with 100 of them. What were some of my favorites? There was one he would do, Christmas in July, you ask? That's right. Santa's Village is coming to the local mall just for July. Christmas in summer? He did another one about San Diego being renamed Boz Skaggs Town for a big Boz Skaggs concert. It was like, it was always like the fun game of usually the bad stories involved animals. Like we had one that was, after the bear destroyed the photo mat booth, he scampered back into the woods. And then Will goes, apparently he wasn't too happy with his color prints. And they both chuckle kind of inanely. But that one always made us laugh because, God, you know, a bear ripping apart a photo mat booth, that's a serious, dangerous story. And just because it's animals, they always play it off light. But animals were definitely the formula. We came up with just hundreds of different animal stories as that sort of being our comment on the local news and their regular stories.
You and Will Ferrell have written together a lot, beginning with Saturday Night Live. How much of this new movie is improvised?
Well, we improvised hours and hours of footage when we were shooting. We would always do two takes as written, and then we would just go and go, and we rolled out all the time. You know, I'd have the cameraman just say, "I'm out," and if we had two cameras going, I'd let the other guy keep rolling. So I'd say as far as what made it to the actual movie, probably about 25%. I mean, there's whole scenes in the movie that came out of improv. Him crying in the phone booth was a one-line scene that he just expanded on. And I gave the brilliant note of keep going, only bigger, you know, which is a great note to give Will. And, actually the Afternoon Delight scene where they sing basically was improvised. Paul Rudd came to me about a week before and said, "Wouldn't it be great if we just sang a perfect four-part harmony version of Afternoon Delight?" And I basically right away was just like, "That's going in the movie." And like the day of, I told them that we were doing it, and they had only rehearsed it for like 10 minutes. So they just kind of came up with the whole scene and did the thing on the spot. So
well, I actually really love that. Why don't you explain the context of it, and then we'll play the song.
Well, basically, they're trying to understand what love is. So they're talking to Ron, and they just can't understand. So finally, he has to break into this perfect rendition of Afternoon Delight.
Well, let's hear it. So this is the cast of Anchorman singing.
Can I apologize?
Oh, for what?
Can I apologize to your listeners before they hear this? All right, let me give a warning to your listeners. If they're driving and they're about to hear this, you may start sobbing. You may want to hug loved ones. So maybe pull over to the side of the road before we play it.
Yeah, here it is.
You really want to know what love is?
Yeah.
Yes, tell us.
More than anything in the world, Ron. Well, it's really quite simple. It's kind of like, gonna find my baby, gonna hold her tight, gonna grab some afternoon delight. My motto's always been, when it's right, why wait until the middle of a cold, dark night? When everything's a little clearer in the light of day, and we know the night is always gonna be here anyway. Thinking of you's working up my appetite. Looking forward to a little afternoon delight. Rubbing sticks and stones together, making sparks ignite. And the thought of loving you is getting so exciting. Sky rockets in flight.
Boo!
Afternoon delight.
Whoop.
You guys have it, I think.
Afternoon delight.
That's Will Ferrell and several other members of the news team in the new movie Anchorman singing Afternoon Delight. Why that song? I mean, why did you all agree that this is the song that they have to do?
No, I think your answer is in the question, why this song? I think that's why. Why in God's name that song? That song explains nothing about love. It seemed like the perfect one to do four-part harmony on. It was either that or If, and If by Bread, and we didn't want to...
Wait, which one is that? Do a few bars of that.
If a picture paints a thousand words, then why can't I paint you? So you can see why we didn't do that one.
Thanks for refreshing my memory. I really hate that song, yeah.
Do you want me to keep refreshing your memory? Should I keep singing it? Or?
You don't need to.
Okay. What if I want to? What if I insist?
You're welcome. You're welcome. You're welcome.
Adam McKay speaking with Terry Gross. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Our guest is Adam McKay, who directed and co-wrote the comedy Anchorman, which is now out on DVD. Terry spoke with him when Anchorman was released.
Will Ferrell is so especially good at thinking that he's really smart and attractive. And can you talk about that thing that he has? I mean, like, there's a great scene where he's like, he's exercising, and he's just doing it for show. And he does not have, you know, like a... One of those.
Be very careful here. Be very careful.
I mean, we see
he
his
has
body.
A wonderful...
He has a wonderful body, right.
He is. He's fantastic at playing those characters.
What I would give for that body. Yeah, go ahead.
I always say that's why his George Bush is so good. You know, he's the master at playing the guy who's, as Hightower said, born on third base and strutting around like he hit a triple. And that's definitely Ron Burgundy. You know, they really, you know, they're in this mid-market. I always called the story a medium-sized fish in a small pond story. And they just think they're ruling the globe. And of course, he's got the mustache. So maybe he's not as wrong as we think.
How did you start working together?
We got hired together at Saturday Night Live. We were hired on the same day. So there was a group of five or six of us, writers and cast, that were hired. And we went out and got beers that night. And we all thought Will was the most normal guy in the world. I mean, he sort of looks like, what's his name, Wayne Rogers from MASH. And then when he started reading scenes in the read-throughs, we're like, holy Lord, he's demented. And instantly the entire writing staff just like fell in love with him. So then on top of it all, it turns out Will's a really, really great writer. And so, yeah, he and I just started sort of writing those strange kind of scenes they always put at the end of the show, the last half an hour ones together.
Can you describe what it was like to watch him work up his impression of George W. Bush?
It actually was a process. I remember the first time we put him in a scene as Bush. I think it was Clinton. It was Daryl doing Clinton and Bush kind of busting in saying, I'm on your tail kind of scene. Pretty soon this Oval Office is going to be mine. And Will just kind of played him like a frat guy. He didn't really do anything. He just kind of came in with a beer and was pumping his fist a lot. And the audience didn't know that much about George W. Bush, so they loved it and was just a beer-drinking kind of frat guy thing. And then it was during the summer break when Bush started sort of emerging, if that's the right description, that Will really started watching him. And when he came back off the summer, suddenly he had all these little, you know, affectations that Bush always uses to sort of punctuate his serious and sincere moments. And once he figured that out, that was kind of the whole impression, was, you know, saying, making the word freedom last for 7 seconds, you know, freedom, you know, and... yeah, it, amazing, though. It was always a freakish impression. We could never believe it.
Did Bush ever give you feedback?
He actually would send us a turkey every Monday morning with a bottle of champagne and just a note that says simply, I love you.
I thought how generous.
No, I know. Actually, that's somewhat feasible, unfortunately. The only feedback I ever heard was I heard a story that I had written a sketch that was called Palm Beach Nights, and it was a soap opera version of the election, the recount scandal. And I had heard a story, it was like, I think in the New York Times or something, about how Bush came into his campaign office and his entire staff was gathered around watching this sketch, and with Will playing Bush, and he got very angry and turned the TV off and told everyone to scatter. And I was reading it going, wait a minute, that's my sketch. So that was the closest I had to feedback. later, Bush in the White House asked Will to come and pay a visit, and you know, at the Correspondents' Press dinner, and then I think later at the White House. And Will felt it was a little weird as a comic playing the president to go visit him, so he ended up not doing it. But that was the only other interaction.
There's a certain type of male that you have satirized in some of your sketches, and certainly in Anchorman. You know, like the frat brother kind of guy who's, you know, not very bright and is drinking a lot of beer. The kind of guy who thinks he's, you know, incredibly smart and has a, you know, absolutely perfect body, a real Adonis, and of course, you know, doesn't. And I mean, there's this great thing in Anchorman where one of the reporters puts on this cologne that he thinks is really, like, super great. And, of course...
Sex Panther, I think you're referring to.
Yes.
Yeah.
But so I figure you were probably never that guy. And if you were, you wouldn't admit it on the show. But but did you know, like, when you were in college, did you know guys who were like this?
Well, you know, I went to Penn State for 1 year before I transferred to Temple University in Philadelphia. And at Penn State, if you're not in a fraternity, there's kind of nothing really going on for you. So I actually tried to kind of assimilate into the frat world. and could never figure out why it never worked. And then finally, a couple of years later, I was like, oh, I'm so happy that didn't work. So, I mean, there's a little bit of us, and Will actually was in a fraternity. There's a little bit of us that kind of did some of this stuff. Like, I remember buying Polo cologne when I was like a sophomore in high school and putting on too much. I think part of it is that, yeah, we had our run-ins with this world. One of my favorite stories is Will was actually in a fraternity at USC. I was really surprised to hear this because we both like to kind of make fun of that world. And he told me that, you know, he joined just because he was new in college and stuff. And he said that one time he got up at a meeting in a very straight-faced way, said to his entire frat that perhaps they should go gay because it would save a lot of money as far as their bills for parties. It would also cut down on liability issues with, you know, sexual assault sort of cases in the fraternities. And he said, and ultimately the main reason I want to do it is because this is about brotherhood, and I can't think of a better way to get closer than if we all went gay. He said, you know, half the frat was really laughing and half of them were like, who is this guy? And kind of taking him seriously. And so, yeah, I think we're more in the world than I wish I could be cool and say I've always laughed at this. But no, I tried cologne and tried hanging out at frats and it just never quite fit. But I think that's part of the reason we also like to laugh at it.
Now, you started off in Second City before getting to Saturday Night Live. Second City is famous for improv. Did you develop characters when you were there that you would do?
Yeah, we had some characters. I had a character I used to always do was the you still got to pay your taxes character, which this guy Scott Adsit and I used to love to do. And it was basically Scott Adsit would play an activist coming to my door. And he would ask me to sign a petition, a very clear petition about the neighborhood and how to help the neighborhood. And I just kept saying things like, you still got to pay your taxes. You can't fight City Hall. And would never sign the petition. And that would be the entire scene. And we would play that ad nauseum in improv sets for like 15 minutes because it made us laugh so hard. But I was never a big character guy. When I auditioned for Saturday Night Live, it was as a performer. And they asked me to do impressions and characters. And I knew I didn't really do impressions. And people at Second City don't really do impressions. That's not really considered that cool at that place for some reason. And so that's why I brought scripts with me. It was like, I better get in as a writer. And thank God I did.
Now, I read that when you were, I guess it's when you were still with Second City and you were living in Chicago, you advertised your own suicide and then what?
I like saying, and then what, at the end of that. I did. I was with a group called the Upright Citizens Brigade in Chicago. And we did a lot of sort of improv sketch kind of street theater prank kind of stuff. I don't even know what you'd call it. And we did things like take the whole audience back to my apartment and let them watch a scene of a fake murder through my windows. We did a scene where Horatio Sanz, who's currently at Saturday Night Live, ended up getting arrested in the middle of North and Damon. He was leading a fake revolution towards City Hall. And we gave the whole audience plastic guns and tiki torches, and he ended up getting arrested. So sort of in the midst of that kind of work, I decided to advertise my own suicide. And I had this really horrible 8x10 I had done for some agent in an attempt to get commercial work of me with the cheesiest smile you'd ever seen. And I just put it in the poster, and I just said, on such and such date, Adam McKay, age, I think I was 27 or 24, will kill himself, no joke. And we went and put it up everywhere. And for us, it obviously was a joke, but some people were quite upset. So we ended up doing it. It was a huge turnout. And I actually got on top of a 5-story building and came out and yelled down to the crowd. And I had a CPR dummy that we had dressed in my exact clothes. And I backed up and tossed it off the edge. And you could actually hear the crowd go, and then we had a character playing the Grim Reaper come out to claim me. And then my friends paid off the Grim Reaper. And I came back to life, and we went back into the theater, and it was great. It's the kind of stuff you could not do in New York or L.A. because you would be arrested instantly, but somehow Chicago is slightly spread out enough that you could get away with this stuff for like 10 minutes.
I'm trying to figure out what I think of this, you know, whether I think it's hysterically funny or just like so unfair to people who think that somebody's truly about to kill themselves.
I don't think anyone really thought I was going to kill myself. I mean, I had some people complain to me about it, and to me, we were so clearly making fun of that, you know, sensationalistic thing. That was the whole joke of it. We advertised it like it was a, you know, a 5-day pass at Disney World to come see this guy kill himself. So, but I can't believe, I think for a second when they saw the dummy come over the edge, there was a little flash of, wait a minute, is he actually crazy? So, yeah. Yeah, I'm not sure how I feel about it either.
And was Action News there?
I wish they had been. They would have, what would their line have been? And for one comic, it was not a very funny night.
That's right. That would have been it.
Adam McKay speaking with Terry Gross. He directed and co-wrote the film Anchorman, just out on DVD, and the upcoming film version of Bewitched. This is Fresh Air.
May I take your order?
Yes, I am going to have 3 fingers of Glenlivet with a little bit of pepper and some cheese. Very good.
I'll take a Manhattan and kick the vermouth in the side with a pair of steel-toed boots.
Certainly.
Thank you, Scott.
Thank you.
Mr. Burgundy!
Gino!
So good to see
you. How are you?
Would everyone love to hear Ron Burgundy play some jazz flute?
Get it going, Ron.
Yes! Please. You, get on stage now.
Okay, I guess I can play a little ditty. Honestly.
Come on! Give him a hand!
I'm not prepared.
Please.
I really am not prepared at all.
Yes!
This is a surprise, I tell you.
Guys, East Harlem Shakedown, E flat. Keep the cymbal splashy, and Jerry, let's take the bass line for a walk.
Hold on. I'm not hearing it right. Hold on. We got it now. It's all right. Little ham and eggs coming at you. Hold on, people. Hope you got your griddles. That's baby making music. That's what that is.
Major funding for Fresh Air comes from this and other NPR member stations, and from Barnes & Noble, publisher of astrologer Susan Miller's The Year Ahead 2005. Available at Barnes & Noble stores and online at bn.com. And from Delta Trade Paperbacks, publisher of The Mapmaker's Wife, A True Tale of Love, Murder, and Survival in the Amazon by Robert Whittaker. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
If you prick us, do we not bleed? If you tickle us, do we not laugh? Coming up, if you make a movie adaptation of Shakespeare's The Merchant of Venice, will our film critic David Edelstein not review it? We'll also hear from Jeremy Irons, who plays Antonio in the film. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, sitting in for Terry Gross. The English actor Jeremy Irons has been described as the thinking woman's pinup for his handsome looks and his sophisticated, elegant style. He's currently starring opposite Al Pacino in a new film version of The Merchant of Venice. Irons plays the merchant Antonio. Pacino plays the moneylender Shylock. A.O. Scott in the New York Times called Irons' performance quietly mesmerizing. We'll hear what our film critic David Edelstein has to say later in the show. Irons first became known for his performance in the British TV adaptation of Brideshead Revisited and went on to star in The French Lieutenant's Woman, Moonlighting, Dead Ringers, M. Butterfly, The Mission, Lolita, and Stealing Beauty. He won an Oscar and a Golden Globe Award for his portrayal of Klaus von Bülow in Reversal of Fortune. Terry Gross spoke to Jeremy Irons in 1998.
Well, I'd like to play a couple of clips from some of your early films and talk a little bit about your acting career. And I thought we would start in 1981 with your movie The French Lieutenant's Woman, in which you played opposite Meryl Streep. The movie was about an actor and an actress who are having an affair while they're making a movie set in Victorian England. And in the film within a film, you play a gentleman who's engaged to a fine middle-class woman but becomes romantically obsessed with a mysterious fallen woman played by Meryl Streep. I want to play a clip from an early scene of the movie within the movie when your character is calling on the fine middle-class woman who he intends to marry.
I came here this morning to inquire whether you would allow me to ask your father for your hand.
Yes, I would allow it.
Mind you, I don't know that he altogether approves of me. After all, I don't do what he considers to be work.
Are you suggesting that it is entirely Papa's decision?
No, it is yours.
Yes, it is. Papa will do what I want, and I will do what I want.
Well, in that case, might you take pity on a crusty old scientist who holds you very dear, and marry me.
Oh, Charles, I've waited so long for this moment.
Now, how did you act in the movie within the movie? Did you see this actor as a great actor giving a great performance, or did you see it as a mediocre performance? Did you want your acting to be really different in the movie within the movie than it was when you were playing a contemporary character?
No, I The movie within the movie, as you call it, although I would say that is the movie, and the relationship between the actor and the actress is the outer movie. But the main story, the period story, is about a man who becomes obsessed with this woman who may or may not be telling the truth, a woman quite outside his social circle. This is a Victorian time when, you know, social circles were very important and you didn't really move outside of them. It was about obsession at a time when you really couldn't behave like this. And then that had to be absolutely real. And then the actor and the actress who weren't having an affair at the beginning of the movie, as you introduced it by saying, the actor became obsessed with the actress because of his relationship with the character in the film. And we see this happening many times. I mean, it is not rare for actors to fall in love with their co-stars during the making of a movie.
Why do you think that's true?
Well, it's very, if they're playing a love story within the movie, the barriers between reality and fantasy in a real relationship are difficult to draw. If you are filming a film relationship, those boundaries are very, very shady. And I think people often fall in love with the character that the actor or the actress is playing. It's a strange area. I mean, if you're experienced, if you've done it a lot, you know what it's about, and you know more clearly, you recognize the boundaries. But you know, you often see young actors or actresses doing that, and then the movie's over, and after sort of 4 months, the relationship dribbles to a halt because they're both off playing different relationships with different people or in different stories.
Now, you've experienced the opposite, too, where you've played opposite your real-life wife. How does that affect things when you already know the person inside out, and then you're...
Well, that's strangely difficult because I'm you're right, I made a movie called Waterland, are playing husband and wife with my wife. And the characters we were playing were very, very different to our characters in life. And normally when you start building a fantasy relationship with an actress, you start with a bare page because you don't know them. And so you both build up this relationship, this history, this what you have between you. If, as my wife and I did, we had, I don't know, 20 years of history in our relationship, you have to try and scrape that board clean, wipe off the chalk marks of your relationship so that you have a bare board upon which you can start building this new relationship. Now, the wiping off of that history is very difficult because, I mean, how do you do that? The way we did it was that my wife moved out. She moved into a hotel, so she wasn't the person making my breakfast in the morning. I would meet her in the makeup chair in the morning, and I'd meet her as I would meet any actress. And we tried to create a relationship that was totally different. And even if we were staying, when we filmed some of it in Philadelphia, and we stayed in the same hotel, but on different floors, and we wouldn't meet. We would meet sometimes in the corridor for a cigarette.
Did you both agree this would be a good idea?
Yeah, I was unsure about it because I like having her about. But she was absolutely sure, and the director was absolutely sure, and he was quite right. By the end of the shooting, well, towards the end of the film, she finished before I did. And she called me and she said, can I move into your suite now? I said, I'm not so sure about that. I think I need to finish this movie on my own. But eventually, she persuaded me.
Let me move on to another movie that you starred in. And this is Reversal of Fortune, the 1990 film in which you played Klaus von Bülow, who was convicted of attempting to kill his wife, Sunny, by injecting her with an overdose of insulin.
He wasn't convicted. He wasn't convicted.
The first time,
accused.
In the first trial.
Oh, right. Beg your pardon.
In the first trial. And the movie is about the appeal in right. which he was represented by Alan Dershowitz, who's played in the movie by Ron Silver. And in this scene, Dershowitz has just taken on the case, and he's asking von Bülow, played by Jeremy Irons, to tell him what happened.
Okay. I gather, though, the older children deny it, Sonny had a problem with pills and alcohol?
Spectacular understatement.
So there must be somebody who saw it, right? Some witness, somebody somewhere, a friend.
You want affidavits?
Yes, I do.
I'll get them.
You'll get them.
You should also know that the drugs prescribed for me were taken by Sonny.
It's a lot of drugs, Klaus.
But the prosecution's allegation that I knew about syringes, injections, totally accurate. Sonny and I used to give ourselves B12 injections in the late 60s. It was quite a fad in London.
Can I explain something to you? The less I know from you, the more options I have. When you tell me the truth, you limit me to a defense that lines up with what you have to say.
But isn't the truth the simplest way, Alan? I mean, why did I stay all day at Sonny's side without calling a doctor? Because Sonny detested doctors. If we called one without her approval, she went berserk. Once she broke her hip and didn't go to hospital for 2 full days.
Klaus, did you hear what I just said?
Of course. Did you hear the judge sentence me?
Sorry. 30 years is a pretty stiff sentence.
Twice trying to murder one's wife, anything less would be monstrous. But for a man like myself, who did nothing.
Jeremy Irons as Klaus von Bülow. Jeremy Irons, tell me what you did with your voice to convey that sense of class privilege, you know, of someone who, like Klaus von Bülow, has a lot of money and seems to be able to use his voice and his eyes to convey his stature and put people in their place.
Well, Klaus... he wasn't English, he was Danish, and so he had a hidden accent that he was trying. He wanted, a bit of a snob, I think, and wanted to very much be part of London society and to sound very English. But there were some things that he couldn't do, a couple of sounds he couldn't make, because he'd been brought up speaking a different tongue.
What sounds do you remember?
The W is always a little bit difficult if you're not used to them, but I wanted him to sound almost more English than the English, but with this slight problem on a couple of consonants.
Now you pitched your voice deeper than it was at the time.
Yeah, I wanted to give him a sort of gravity. I mean, Klaus was I think about 15 years older or maybe 20 years older than I was. So we had to find ways to give me the weight of those years. We thinned my hair. I took my voice down lower. I wanted to have a sort of slimy charm. I remember talking to women who knew Klaus, and some of them actually told you an awful lot about the women, more about the women than about Klaus, really, because some of them adored him, and some of them found him so repellent that they couldn't sit next to him. And that is very interesting. It tells you a lot about what women find attractive in men.
Did you have to have in your mind whether you thought he was guilty or innocent as you were playing him?
Well, I didn't have to have in my mind whether I thought he was. I had to know whether I was guilty or innocent. I mean, he knew, and I was him. So, yes, of course I had to know.
And what did you believe that he believed?
I believed he was innocent, but I didn't want the audience to know that.
Right.
Because his friends were divided in life about his guilt or his innocence. I think he carried a certain amount of guilt. In my opinion, he carried the guilt of a man who had left his wife too long before calling for help. But you have to remember, this is a wife who had no desire to live, and who, when the first time he pulled her back from a suicide attempt, she gave him a very, very hard time. And so when somebody tries to do it again, what do you do? If somebody wants out, you know, it's very hard to stop them. And as a husband, you keep pulling them back, especially if you're having an unhappy time with each other.
Jeremy Irons speaking with Terry Gross. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's 1998 interview with Jeremy Irons. He's starring with Al Pacino in a new film version of The Merchant of Venice.
Now, I know one of your early roles was in the 60s rock musical Godspell.
You don't have to laugh when you say that.
You were John the Baptist. What were your songs?
Prepare Ye the Way of the Lord, All for the Best, and then the other ones that we sang together.
Sing a few lines of one of them.
Oh. Some men are born to live at ease, doing what they please, richer than the bees are in honey, never growing old, never feeling cold. I can't remember it. It's so long ago. I could hardly remember it then. But it was a tap number. It was the first show I ever did in London, and it was the show during which, I suppose I'd been an actor for about 6 years by then, 7 years. It was the show during which that I knew I had entered the right profession.
Right. Now, I understand you were also a busker for a while, and that you'd perform on the street, sometimes in movie lines. What kind of songs would you do then?
Oh, Bob Dylan, Peter, Paul and Mary. Good old folk songs, you know.
Do you have a guitar?
Yeah, I do. I do. I rarely travel without it. And it means a lot to me. When I travel, I like to travel with a musical instrument. I like to be able to sit and relax and sing. At that time, I was not smoking, and so when I, instead of lighting a cigarette, I'd pick up the guitar, and it's difficult to smoke when you're playing the guitar, and I would spend the evening sitting with friends, drinking, playing the guitar, and not smoking.
No, I'm glad you mentioned smoking, because I always wondered, you know, I gave up smoking years ago. I always wondered, like, if I were an actor, which I'm not, and I had given up smoking, and I had to smoke for a movie, would I get hooked all over again? Have you had to encounter that?
I have, interestingly, yes, because I stopped for 2 years, and I'm very, very ashamed of the fact that I've taken it up again. But I stopped for 2 years while I was making Lolita, because I wanted to put on weight for Humbert. I didn't want him to be gaunt. And I find that I eat more when I don't smoke, and I do put on weight. And I was also not smoking through Chinese Box, and I had to smoke a cigarette in that. We were in Hong Kong. I said, will you get me one of those vegetable cigarettes, you know, that don't have any nicotine, any tobacco in them. And they couldn't get them out there. So eventually I said, oh, well, I'll just have a normal cigarette. And I smoked the normal cigarette during the scene, didn't much enjoy it, and it had no effect at all, which is interesting. However, when I went back onto cigarettes again afterwards, I just had the one, and within a week I was back to 30 a day.
Yeah.
So you know, I think when you're playing a character, you're somewhere else.
Right, right.
Do you know?
Right. I want to move on to another movie, Dead Ringers, which you made in 1988, directed by David Cronenberg. And you played a dual role in this, identical twin gynecologists who kind of exchange identities when they want to with each other in both their professional lives and in their love lives. But they're also kind of mad, particularly one of them. And in this scene, one of the brothers has gotten hooked on prescription drugs, uppers and downers, and the other brother's trying to detox him by keeping him in the house and standing watch over him, making sure he doesn't take anything. So this clip starts with the addicted brother who desperately wants a sleeping pill from the other brother. Here we go.
Ellie, I can't sleep. If you're asking me for a sleeper, I'll tell you right now, you're not going to get one.
But what am I going to do then?
You'll stay up.
Ellie, I'll die if I don't sleep.
You'll stay up. What if I take something when you go home? I'm staying right here.
What if I take something when you go to sleep?
I won't go to sleep.
How do you stay awake?
I'll take something.
You'll take an up so that I don't take a down. This is crazy.
Bev, don't worry about me. I'm not you.
Great scene. Great film. Jeremy Irons, what was it like playing identical twins who had to look exactly the same yet be distinguishable to the audience watching the movie?
Well, it is a nice game to play. I had to find a way, an internal way, to make them different so that I knew who I was because I felt different, which I did. An internal energy which was placed really in a different place in my body, which made me feel quite different as one to the other. And when I then played one pretending to be the other, I was able to keep the energy in the same place but try to put the mannerisms of the other onto that.
No, what do you mean by keeping the energy in the same place?
Well, have you ever done anything like the Alexander? You've done yoga?
I've done Alexander, yeah.
Alexander, right. Well, you know about, you know, the feeling of the energy coming up the spine and out of the top of the head.
Right.
Which pulls you up. So you know about placing energies within yourself.
What Jeremy Irons is talking about is a kind of a body placement posture technique that I think a lot of actors and musicians study.
That's right.
Yeah.
And Reiki massage uses it. I mean, energy, mm-hmm. energy points and whatever. And I would put the energy of one of the twins in my forehead, which is sort of where the third eye is, and it's a very powerful place. It makes you stand in a particular way. It makes you live very much on the front foot, gives you great energy, a little bit of aggression, makes your eyes sparkle. It just feels very bright, a bright place to have the energy. And that was for one of the twins, for Elliot. And the other one, I put his energy in his Adam's apple, in his throat, which makes everything different, makes the posture different, makes the sound, the energy within the voice different, and takes some of the energy out of the eyes and just changes everything. And so by moving it from one to the other, I could make these guys apparently different and understandable to the audience. It was a simple trick.
Now, when you were shooting scenes with the two brothers in the same scene, would you shoot the scene alternating back and forth between the two brothers, or shoot just all one brother and then shoot all the other brother?
Yeah, I would do. There weren't many scenes like that where they were both in the same. Well, both in the same shot. We used the motion control camera when that was necessary, which is an interesting process. But no, I would do one brother and then I'd go and change into the other brother and come on and do the other side. I had a tremendous stand-in who would be my eye line as the other brother, so that I would be looking at in the right place, although eventually that person would not be there and I would be there. A very selfless role he had, because he had to sublimate his own ego completely.
Now, this is a very creepy movie. There are scenes...
Isn't it creepy?
Oh, yeah.
Very
creepy. I think especially creepy for women to watch. You know, these are gynecologists who have created these really weird instruments to use for internal gynecological exams. And they're obsessed with the insides of bodies and the inner beauty and the inner ugliness of bodies. And they're convinced that some insides are really deformed and other insides are really beautiful. What kind of reactions did you get from women who you know who saw the movie?
Well, before I did the movie, everybody said, don't touch it. My wife and my agent, who are both women, said, don't touch it. This is hopeless. And I knew that it would be a lot of fun for an actor to play two identical twins. I mean, it's a great challenge, that, and so I wanted to do it for that reason. When people then saw the movie, they were sort of hideously fascinated, the women especially. I think they, you know, I think when you see any movie, you think, there but for the grace of God go I. And many women who had to go in for examinations thought, well, at least my gynecologist is not like that. but
a small consolation, yeah.
A small consolation. But I'm always fascinated that that is the piece of work of mine which people keep going back to and say that, you know, that really was the apogee, which is nice.
Well, Jeremy Irons, thank you so much for talking with us.
It's been a great pleasure.
Jeremy Irons speaking with Terry Gross in 1998. He appears opposite Al Pacino in a new screen adaptation of The Merchant of Venice. Coming up, film critic David Edelstein gives us his take on the film. This is Fresh Air. Jeremy Irons plays the merchant Antonio in a new screen version of Shakespeare's problematic play The Merchant of Venice. Al Pacino plays the moneylender Shylock. Film critic David Edelstein says the movie works better when it stops trying to get around the play's anti-Semitism.
Michael Radford's film of William Shakespeare's The Merchant of Venice is steeped in guilt like a toxic smog. It opens with titles that inform us of the status of Jews in 16th century Venice. They were ghettoized, they were reviled, and they were confined by law to occupations like money lending. That overture seems a thoughtful solution to the problem posed by this frankly anti-Semitic play. But as Stephen Greenblatt points out in his brilliant new book, Will in the World, Shakespeare had probably never met any Jews. They certainly weren't in evidence in Elizabethan England, where even being openly Catholic was a recipe for getting one's severed head affixed to London Bridge. The character of Shylock must have begun life as a stock villain in a romantic comedy with serious overtones, not unlike Much Ado About Nothing. But Shakespeare, by this point, was incapable of creating a one-dimensional schemer like Marlowe's contemporaneous Jew of Malta, and Shylock ended up with a weight and rough eloquence that warped this strange and imperfect play. In recent years, humanist theater directors have tried to portray Shylock as more sinned against than sinning, which really warps the play. Radford and Al Pacino don't make that mistake. This Shylock is so beaten down that he embraces the role of monster. In the past, he has reached out to Christian society and been spat on, literally in a prologue by Antonio, the devout merchant of the title, played by Jeremy Irons. For once, the scale of Pacino's performance seems right. He sometimes sing-song, and he chews the scenery. I mean, when does he not? But he also takes Shylock deep inside himself. He's gnomish and gnarled, and he burns hotter and hotter, like a human filament. More important, Pacino mines all the obsessive poetry, so that when Antonio's ships are lost at sea and his debt forfeited, Shylock's demand for a pound of the merchant's flesh becomes an unholy incantation.
Jailer, look to him! Tell me not of mercy! This is the fool lent out money gratis. Jailer, look to him.
Hear me yet, good Shylock.
I'll have my bond. Speak not against my bond. I have sworn an oath that I will have my bond. You called me dog before you had a cause. But since I am a dog, beware my fangs. The Duke will grant me justice. I do wonder, you wicked jailers, you are so fond to come abroad with him at his request.
I pray you hear me speak.
I'll have my bond. I will not hear you speak. I'll have my bond. Therefore, speak no more. I'll not be made a soft and dull-eyed fool to shake the head, relent, and sigh, and yield to Christian intercessors. I'll have no speaking. Follow not. I will have my bond.
The subsequent courtroom scene is the heart of the movie, and director Radford proves adroit at juggling our sympathies. Jeremy Irons is all liquid eyes and trembling lips as the anguished Antonio, who has lost not only his fortune, but also the young man with whom he's wildly in love, Joseph Fiennes as Bassanio. As the heiress Portia, Bassanio's new wife, and in her disguise as a male law clerk, the potential savior of Antonio, Lynn Collins finds all the transcendent spirituality in Portia's celebrated ode to Christian mercy. Finally, there is the riveting spectacle of Pacino's Shylock walking into, no, hurling himself into a trap, a comeuppance for the vengeful Jew that would have delighted Elizabethan audiences, who also loved watching bears torn limb from limb. But Radford doesn't solve the problems of The Merchant of Venice, which nowadays is too disturbing to be played for comedy and too unresolved to qualify as tragedy, or even that ever-shifting hybrid tragicomedy. Portia's own quality of mercy is strained. She is, all in all, a spoiled and self-centered little princess, and the other characters don't have the stature to make the various lovers' tests of loyalty seem anything but capricious and inconsequential. Radford throws the play even more off balance by making the first half of the movie hushed and dark, with a palette like Velázquez. It's evocative, but with the comic energy ratcheted way down, it's also deeply boring, at least until Antonio suffers an economic catastrophe and looks to be coming in for a small weight loss. That's when this Merchant of Venice comes roaring to life, when it stops, in effect, apologizing for its terrible anti-Semitic worldview and just gives itself over to some of the most furious courtroom drama ever written. You can contextualize the play, frame it humanistically, celebrate Shakespeare for not being Marlowe, but you can't get around the lousy lot of the Jew in the Western canon.
David Edelstein is film critic for the online magazine Slate. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Ian Chillog directed the show. WHYY's executive producer of national radio programming is Elizabeth Perez Luna. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.
CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrell's at 1-877-213-7374. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio. Break them.
On the next Fresh Air, rapper actor Ice Cube. He used to rap with NWA, now he's putting the G in PG. He's starring in a new family comedy, Are We There Yet? Join us for the next Fresh Air.
Just waking up.